Title of the message is, Who is this man Jesus? Mark 6, 1 through 5. Jesus left there and went to his hometown, accompanied by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things? They asked. What is this wisdom that has been given him? What are these remarkable miracles he is performing? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son, the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simeon? Aren't his sisters here with him? And they took an offense at him. Jesus said to them, A prophet is not without honor except in his own town, among his relatives, and in his own home. He could not do any miracles there except to lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. He was amazed at their lack of faith. I heard a story this week. I occasionally troll through the stations on my satellite radio. I listen to Joel Osteen every now and then, and I have various different other channels programmed in just to see what everyone is saying. And on there, he started his message out with his story, and if I can remember it correctly, I hope I'll get through it. There was three boys, I'm assuming they were brothers, after church, and they had just received a dog, and their puppy was given to them by somebody. And they were trying to figure out who would own the dog. You know, there's always somebody's got to own the dog, right? And the rest of them help to take care of it. And so they decided that the winner would be the person who told the biggest lie. So they were telling these lies amongst themselves, and out comes the minister, and he hears what's going on and asks him what they're doing. And they're saying, well, the person who tells the biggest lie gets the puppy. So he proceeded to preach to them about why people shouldn't lie and all the downfalls of lying. And he says, I don't lie. He says, Pastor, you get the puppy. Then he went on to say some more things that I'll try to tie in. He says that God stores up blessings for people, even though there's a period of time when they may not be living their life according to what God has planned for them. And so he says that even though your family may have been away from God and you return to God, God doesn't give away your blessings. He gives them to you if you return. And he uses the story as an illustration of the Israelite people when they left Egypt, that the Egyptians gave them their gold and their silver as a back wage for their slavery, their time of slavery. I'm not sure I quite believe that theology in that perspective, but today I want to start the message with about leaving home, and is there a blessing in that? Parents might look at it that way, but in some respect, can we look at as that what is stored up for us may be given us as we leave home and provide for ourselves. In the story today, Jesus returned to his hometown and didn't really get accepted real well. We'll get to that in a little bit. So I read several articles on the pros and cons of one leaving the home in which they were raised and going and living some other place, versus people or young adults who stay at home and grow up in their hometown and never leave it. There's no real conclusive evidence if it's better or worse. There's pros and cons both way. I was gonna give some of the data, but I'm not gonna do that. I'm gonna use my own life as an illustration and we'll go from there. I left home when I was 18, and I turned 19 when I was in Phoenix, Arizona. I went out with a friend of mine. we were Mennonites at the time, or acting as Mennonites. And so he got called into service, and he had to do alternate service, and we always went and worked in hospitals in various different places. And so I chose to go along with him out to Arizona. I wasn't probably the best youth that you could think of. I had a lot of inner struggle, a lot of things that I had to deal with or should have dealt with and didn't know how to deal with. And when I went to Arizona, in that year or so that I was out there, I got a lot of things worked out. It was a good period of time for me to sort things out. And I came back home, and I moved up into the Canton area, and there I continued to live, and then I am in this area ever since. For me, it was a good thing to go and leave home and never come back. I never moved back in with my parents, and I'm not saying that people who do move back in their parents, that is bad. How does one know whether or not it is good or bad? Because the life you live, you don't have a chance to go back and relive it and know the difference. I think there's blessings in both ways, myself. I sometimes think that if you travel around, you have a broader perspective of things. And those who don't seem to. But I'm not sure that's really true either. With the age of communication in which we have, one can share, one can learn from TV programs and what have you, and shared stories. One can grow either way. I used to contribute some of my wife's things that she did that I didn't necessarily like. Necessarily, she was a person who was born in a particular area and never left. I, on the other hand, was not. But as later years go on, I think it's probably just both to our characteristics of each one of us, individual characteristics. I don't necessarily attribute it to her not traveling any or never moving out or me traveling out. I've learned to accept the beautiful things in our relationship and some of the things that are different. It's all part of what makes our relationship good. I don't see, again, that it really made much difference. I still continue to travel. I drive truck. I see a lot of different things. And some days I get sick and tired of seeing things. I like to just go home and park.
I think if you live and think like your parents, it's a good idea to stick around. If you don't, you better leave.
Well, that was pretty much my case. I didn't quite think the way my parents did in the church that they went to. I think it is good to have an independent life, but that doesn't seem statistically is happening as much as it once did. People don't move around as much as what they once did. Between 2010 and 2011, only about 11 or 12% of people moved from where they were raised and born. They didn't pick up sticks and go elsewhere. We tend, right now, we are tending to not move as much. It's down quite a bit. 40% of young adults live with their parents or a relative now. That's a 2016 statistic. The highest in 75 years since after the Depression, that was the last time when a lot of people lived in families together. I was raised that some of my relatives were Amish and they believed in a large family. You just added another piece to your house and another piece to your house. And you had several generations that just simply lived in your house all the time. I can remember going to see my grandmother who lived with her oldest son. There was a guest house. That was usually part of it. Generally, it was a part of the house, and it was a continuation. Many cultures still have that today. We in the United States tend to put our old folks in homes, and we don't. That's how we deal with them. But generally speaking, I think in the world over, a lot of people live together, and I don't see anything wrong with that. Europeans, about half live at home until they're at the age of 30. I found that to be interesting. And what is not normal for them is having a large debt when they leave the home. They don't have that. course, a lot of it has to do with probably some of their policies that the government have and whatnot. We here tend to think that our children have large debt and sometimes before they start into their life. I know several people who have tremendous educational debt that probably will take a lifetime to pay. It's one of the issues we deal with in this country. So the question I want to deal with somewhat today is, to start with, did Jesus travel? The question that I, because traditionally it is thought that Jesus lived in his hometown and he was a carpenter, learned a trade of his father, Joseph, and he was a carpenter most of his life. And then at the age around 29 or 30, he started his ministry. But there is a controversy on whether or not Jesus traveled. Joseph of Arimathea, he had was a great friend of Jesus who had a fleet of ships, the way I understand. He was in the shipping business. And there are various different stories that Jesus traveled around with this man. Joseph of Arimathea is the one who whose tomb that Jesus was buried in. He's the one that carved out the tomb. The idea is that Jesus traveled up into England, and Glastonbury is another story that is somewhat documented. The problem is none of this can really be documented. It's semi-documented. There's very little hard facts. Some say he traveled over into India and went into various different places. I have no problem with Jesus traveling. I think it was probably what he must have traveled to some degree. As I said, we don't have any idea what Jesus did from about 13 to about 29. There's no data to back it up. I take it from this story that either Jesus left and came back because they were amazed at the change in which he was or what happened to him as he left and came back. The question, I think, is what they dealt with and which we deal with is, was Jesus a human or was Jesus divine? Or was he both? That was a really big argument right from the very beginning of Christianity, when within the first 300 years. Neither side could come up with enough to agree that the other was right, and so they put the two together and they said Jesus is totally human and Jesus is totally divine. That's where we get this idea that Jesus is both, because neither side could agree. What's new, right? We don't agree. That's pretty much been that way ever since. So my idea is, what I accept about Jesus is this. I think at the age, somewhere around the age of 12 or 13, he went up to the synagogue, and we know the story in which he was and preached and taught, and they were all amazed. I think at some point in time, he left home, and he traveled. I don't see anything wrong with that idea. Surely he must have traveled. He must have went and visited around. I don't see any issue with that, and then at some point in time, he came back. Doesn't mean that he left and never came back. He may have come back and done various different journeys. That's the another thought too. There's no reason why that if Joseph of Arimathea was in the shipping business that he wouldn't have met other travelers along the way, boats that went different places and traveled around. That was probably done in his day, and Joseph of Arimathea probably took care of him money-wise. And because they were very close friends. The next question I want to deal with is the children, Jesus, Mary having children. This is a controversy. This is one text which is hard to get around if you have various different ideas. If you believe in Immaculate, that Mary was the Immaculate Conception and that she never had children and that she was remained a virgin after she had Jesus, as the Catholic Church believes, then you would say that this, you would have a problem with this particular chapter and what was written down by Mark. Because it clearly says that Mary's sons, it doesn't say her cousins, it doesn't say relatives, it says her sons. So there's about three different major theories on what is accepted. And you can accept, I'm not asking you to accept whatever. You can believe it's the church in which we believe, yes.
If you have brothers and sisters, she must have been, have children.
Well, that's, the Catholic Church said that they were cousins, that they were Joseph's children from a previous marriage. That's theory one, that they were cousins and not actually Mary's children. That comes from intertestamental writing, apocryphal writing that the Catholic Church accepts as real. So that's one particular idea, that they were Jesus's cousins. The second one was that she did have children with Joseph and had all these that they said. The third idea, that's the traditional idea, that Joseph and Mary had children after, you know, they were married and they had children and lived a normal life. But what is accepted is that Joseph was quite a bit older than Mary, and that Joseph died at some particular point in time. And I read an interesting one theory that I never quite heard before in preparing for this message, and that it was that Joseph died before he had any children, and under Jewish law, Mary would have had to, Joseph's brother would have had to step in and to take, because Mary wouldn't have had any children, she would have had, if you don't have a son, then Jewish law says that the deceased brother steps in and marries, and it takes on the widow in order to produce a son, so the lineage continues. And that particular person's name was Cleavis. I have no way, and I've read this whole, and it somewhat makes sense, but again, this is something we don't know. It depends on how you see Mary and Jesus and how you see his family. What is true in all three theories is that no one knows the father of Jesus. No one, unless you really get out an exotic thought or extreme thought, all three of these say that Jesus was divinely conceived. So I don't have an issue. It's however you want to see them. But it is a contentious idea. I don't know what you think. That's okay. You can share it if you like. But it also says that Jesus had sisters. Some Mary, a Mary of some sort, and Salome is supposed to be Jesus' sister. Again, this is a technical debate. And to me, it's of little issue because Jesus still remains divinely conceived and divine in nature. I believe that Jesus was divine in a human form. However you want to take that, and still a lot of it is a mystery to me. I'm not really sure. I think there's a lot of things that are a mystery in the Bible. Yes, Sam?
Was Mary traveling with him, the one they think?
I don't know if any of them traveled with him. I think he traveled alone. You're talking about from the age of 13 to 20-something?
No, I was thinking later.
Well, at the cross was a Mary Magdalene, and they're not really sure the relationship. That's a whole controversy there, too. Who stood at the cross? So does anybody want to add something to that? Anybody want to venture the Marys that were at the cross? Carol, you're smiling.
Right.
Yeah. Right. That's exactly the way I see it. You can choose what you like, And that's okay with me. And not that you have to reckon any of your thoughts with me. That doesn't, you know, yes.
I'll go one step further. What difference does it make?
Well, it's interesting because there's a lot of people who put a lot of time and a lot of effort in it to try to understand it.
And they need to get a light, it seems.
Well, I think that's a little narrow.
Their
I think that's a little narrow coming from a person who's a history teacher who specializes in the Civil War. He's got blinders on pretty much, right? I think that's a, not to be critical of you, Bob, but I think that's being a little bit narrow. Some people find it very interesting, and I find it interesting to read. So it's interesting. I think it's interesting that people devote their lives to figuring, looking at Scripture and looking at history and trying to determine what happened. I don't adhere to Dan Brown's theory about Jesus never really died and went across the Mediterranean over to France, I think it is, or Spain, France, and there lived and raised and actually was married and had children. There's no proof of that whatsoever. That's really, really out there that Dan Brown goes off. And even he says so in his book, that it's just a theory, there's no evidence whatsoever. So that's a little bit further than I'm going to go. But nevertheless, it's interesting. I try to stick a little more closer to reality than going out that far. I did find the movies rather interesting. I enjoyed the movies, that's for sure. But I don't quite go there. A prophet, I'll back up a minute. What amazed them was the wisdom that Jesus had and how he spoke. And I think that's where I think really Jesus is the highest teachings that we know to mankind. He took things as simple as, if you look at the Sermon on the Mount, in which he lists quite a few things, in which he takes and adds something to it and spiritualizes and makes it much more. He's not a legalist by any stretch of the imagination, even though he does things that may be seen as being legalism. The first one is salt and light. So we are to add flavor and have give light and wellness to everyone we meet. So this is one of the places where I get the idea that Jesus teaches is an ingredient. It's like salt. Salt adds flavor. Back then, salt was a big thing. You didn't have salt, and even today, I say you can make anything taste good with salt and sugar. You add them two ingredients in it, and you can make anything taste good. Whatever amount you want to do. I eat some spaghetti sauce already that I know it wasn't nothing more than a can of tomato sauce, but it had lots of sugar and salt in it, it tasted good. So anything can taste good. So the idea that Jesus' teachings can add flavor to us is where I go. And it's a light in which we have a light to the world. And then he goes on to talk about the law. He makes the law, he says that legalism falls short. I made a little summation of each one along the way. And we're dealing with anger. He says you're supposed to live in peace or settle your differences. Or that there's such a thing as spiritual murder. Excuse me. He taught about lust. In other words, if you think it, you've already done it. That's a lot further on than what a legalistic point of view is. So he added an ingredient much higher than what the Jewish law was at the time. The teaching on divorce, I wrote, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. Divorce was legal. There was a way of doing it. But I sum it up as a broader teaching. Well, just because you can doesn't mean that you should. Doesn't make it right. Just because you can do something legally doesn't make it right. Teaching on vows. Who knows the future? How can you swear against that you're going to be where you're going to be? Because Jesus says, you don't know the future. We don't know the future. Revenge, find another way. You know, an eye for an eye, that was a total legalistic way. You know, if the balance between the two. But you were supposed to turn the other cheek. These were ideas, and even today, these are really hard things to live by. You should find another way to do it. Turning the cheek meaning you can't hit somebody. You have to think of some way different. Love your enemies, Jesus taught that. To me, I think it takes more energy to hate than it does to love. It's easier to forgive and to move on than it is to hold that grudge and let it grind and grind and grind in on you. Forgiveness is a method of healing. Just because you can prosecute somebody doesn't mean it's right to prosecute them. There's a time when forgiveness is much better. So Jesus took these things made them more. Giving to the needy. You're not supposed to see what one hand does to the other. In other words, you're supposed to give without remembering. That's a new idea. You know, the Jewish people, like when they prayed, they went out in the street corner and made a big deal out of it. Jesus said, you're not supposed to do those things. So he added more and more things to it. And you're supposed to be thankful in your prayer, not always adding for a whole list of things. I want this and I want that and I want this. It's not an idea of once. We should be thankful. Fasting, we're supposed to do things, in secret. You know, sometimes we don't have to have everything we do out in the front. You know, I did this, I did that, I did the next thing, I did that. Some people like to list everything they did and show it in front of your face and say, look what I did, what are you doing? I think that we can go any direction with there. The love of money, spiritual things are more important. Worry, relax. There isn't much you're going to do about it anyway. Life goes on, right? Every day. So you know, not to worry. Judging on others. Seeing the speck in someone else when we have a beam in our own. I wrote down, when you see someone else's troubles or evils, that's a mere reflection of your own. Because you have some in yourself. I made simple little things along the way I wrote down. Seeking and knocking, he says, God will give you what's best for you. We don't, and I think one has to try, strive, and to search. And look at our Sunday school class, how we talk and we don't understand, by talking in conversation, we learn along the way. Narrow is the gate, a way to heaven. Well, this is probably a lot of controversy done on that one. I think it's a small spot in our brain that finds our way to heaven. That's what I see it as. I don't see it as only a few people make it and other ones don't, which I've been taught ever since. But I think of all the things that happen in our brain, there's only one little small spot somewhere that we call the God spot, which I think is the narrow way to heaven. So it's just, how do you understand these things? How do you apply these things in a lot of different ways? Building a solid foundation. Don't be fooled. And that's about as far as I'm going to go. That's not too much more. But you get what I understand. And so Jesus was teaching all these things, and people were amazed because they were totally different. Even today, they're totally different. How do you live these things out? And where did he get them from? I think sometimes the stories that I hear about people who leave and come back, they remember what that person was like when they were growing up, and they don't forget that. So it was how was Jesus in his childhood? Well, there's some apocryphal writings and whatnot that said he did various different things. I can't imagine he wasn't more than a typical youth in some respect, and some of them writings show that. Whether you believe them writings or not, it's up to you. So maybe in the idea that his hometown folks didn't accept him and didn't acknowledge him is because they remembered how Jesus was, and now suddenly he's this great teacher. And he's saying that sometimes when you come to your hometown, you're not accepted in the way that you are elsewhere. And I think that can be somewhat true. People are willing to accept you as you are as you move away from your home setting. I have been, since I have been preaching and starting to teach and whatnot years ago, I had a friend of mine, dear friend of mine, who got really angry at me and asked me what I thought I was doing and that I wasn't worthy of this position. And I don't know, we're still friends, but I know I'm not worthy of this position. He didn't have to tell me that, but God has placed me here and I can't do much about it. I have to, there wasn't really a choice. I was either gonna do it or else.
We're pretty grateful every day thinking you're gonna be here next Sunday too.
Well, there's always, I'm replaceable. So that's...
Everybody probably is replaceable, but we're still going to be continue to be glad that you're here.
But my point is that my friend of mine knew me as we grew up, and I wasn't the best person either. I mean, I'd done a lot of things that, you know, some things, nothing really drastic, but, you know, things that were not always the best. And I think we all could probably say that there's things along the way in our life that we didn't do, that we did that were not the best. But that doesn't mean you change. You change and you grow
and learn.
And I certainly feel that I've been blessed in a lot of different ways along the way, for sure. And I still don't feel that I'm worthy of the position that I'm in, but yet I'm here and I'm going to do the best I can. And that's all I can do. And I think in that excerpt, I think that's where I think I would put that, is that they had a hard time understanding Jesus, who he was, and so they didn't accept him. But what amazed me also when he says at the very end of the text is that he couldn't do many miracles because he didn't have any faith. I thought that was very interesting, that faith is necessary, that one must believe before one gets healed, or one must believe in order for one to advance in their spiritual life. I think faith has a lot to do with it. You enter into faith that you are searching along the way and you are reaching out. Belief, is that all that's necessary? Is that all we have to have is belief and faith? Faith and belief. I think that's, yes.
I think if you think you're sick before you get done, you're going to be.
If you think you're what?
If you think you're sick, after a while you will be.
Yeah. So if you say you're saved and you think you're saved, then you're saved, right?
Yeah.
I think faith and belief does have a lot to do with it. I think that is certainly a doorway to start the process, for sure. But I think people can feel depressed and not believe and have a lot of struggle, and God will still save them too. So I think faith and belief comes in a lot of different forms. We tend to think in Christian faith that you utter some words and you say some things and you do catechism or whatever you want to call it, confirmation, and you're one of the chosen few. But I think belief and faith comes in many different forms. And I refuse to judge anybody and no matter what, because we're all dealt a hand. Sometimes it's not always the best hand. People struggle, like now, with addictions of various different sorts. That seems to be very, very high. People struggle with, and I would never say that those people died without being saved. I think, why would a God of love desert somebody in the most desperate hours of their life as they are struggling with addiction, and God just says, forget it. I don't think that's true at all. Yeah.
I can't say 100%, but I say that percentage must be up there.
Deathbed confessions is even that is contentious in the Christian faith. Some people don't accept them as being real because you have to have. I had a brother that I had a message on a while back, who had an adopted son that had a drug addiction problem, and they weren't sure he was saved because no one heard him utter the words and say the right things. And so even in the funeral, it was expressed by the pastor that they weren't sure if Jesus took him home or not. And I just don't follow that at all. I am sorry, I just don't. Like you said, I don't know, and it's none of my business. It's between that person and God. And even if that person denies to the very end, God still can, by his grace through Jesus Christ, make that person see. And there is an idea that God will forcibly save every human being. I definitely believe that God is a God of love and compassion and understanding, and that I think God does love diversity, as Jeannie so well says so many times. Otherwise, look at the human race. And I think we can think various different things, and we're still good and God's gracious.
Unfortunately, it's not up to me to decide on somebody else's fate.
Right. I tell people I'm not in the judging business.
I don't want to be the judge.
Yeah. They ask me how I can be in such a liberal church. I say, oh, I'm not in the judging business. I'm here to give the message and show God's love, however it is. I'm not judging nobody. And, of course, I've been told that you should judge people and that Christians have the right to judge people. But I don't adhere to that thinking either. I believe, again, we serve a God of love and compassion who loves all, everybody. And I will stop there.
Who is that man? Oh, who?